Hello there, and welcome to the very first episode of the Raw Room podcast for 2020. And I'm happy with what we're kicking off today because it is a really interesting, about 45-minute long conversation with the absolute legend who is Joe Cornish. Joe Cornish is probably one of the best landscape photographers in the world, definitely the UK. He has been a massive inspiration of mine since I was very young because he was sort of famous for shooting and documenting and creating these beautiful images of the area that I grew up in around the North York Moors in North Yorkshire. So it was an absolute thrill to have him on the channel, on the YouTube channel. If you haven't, I did make a video that went out yesterday. If you haven't seen that, it's probably best to watch the video first before listening to this full conversation. But if you're in the car and you're listening to this podcast, then just go ahead and listen to it. It's not going to detract from the video if you're going to watch that later. But I've known Joe for a while. He works with Light and Land, who's run by Charlie Waite. So that's how I got to know Joe a little bit. And he, like I said, was very kind to agree to come onto the channel. So we spent the day together last Friday at Brimham Rocks in North Yorkshire. And during the course of the shoot, we sat down and just had a conversation. We covered various topics from Joe's sort of origins in photography, what he used to do as a photographer, a bit about his business now, and talked a little bit about environmental stuff, shooting locally. So loads of interesting stuff within this conversation. You get a real sense, an insight into Joe's sort of thought process around photography and just life generally, I think. So it is a really interesting conversation. So before we get into that, though, I just wanted to let you know that the Raw Room, I'm now offering a 7-day free trial. So you can sign up. You still have to put your credit card details in, but you get a 7-day free trial. So you get, and during that, you get access to absolutely everything, which includes the Landscape Photography Masterclass, the Raw Room, the Water Drop Photography Masterclass. There's loads of other tutorials and videos. There's a monthly challenge on there. Loads of other stuff. So give it a try. 7-day free trial. You can cancel at any time. But I hope that you will think there's enough there to keep you subscribed for a little while. I do think it's probably worth it for many of you. I'm really proud of the stuff that's on there. Anyway, without further ado, let's just get into that conversation with Joe Cornish. Yeah, I really hope you enjoy it as much as I did.
Inevitably. Have you been up to that spot?
Right? Yes, many times, yeah. I was just going to tell you a little story about it, because I'll tell you now, I was up there doing a review of one of the Fujifilm medium format style cameras. I think it was the 50R or something.
Yeah.
And I'd been all over. I'd been to the Lake District, I'd been to Sands End. Then I went back to, didn't get exactly what I wanted in either of those places, so I went and thought, I'm going to go back to where I know and have a look at Rosby Topping. And the second I got there, it started snowing.
Oh, cool.
It was absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
I got up to that spot overlooking Rosby Topping.
Cliff Ridge.
And the snow was sort of coming in and hitting the trees and sort of sticking to the trees. It was fantastic. The light wasn't perfect though, so I got a couple of shots that I was quite happy with. And then at the end of the day, I'd finished filming, and this sort of warm evening light just sort of struck the trees with the snow on it. And I thought, wow, I'm gonna do something with that. So I set this composition up with some of the trees in the foreground and then Rosby Topping in the background. Didn't talk about it on the vlog as I normally would, and then got home. I was really happy with the picture, and then I printed it, and I worked on it a little bit for the print. I just couldn't get it right for some reason. And then there was something just nagging me in the back of my mind as to why this image wasn't right. And then I was looking at your website possibly, and I just came across the image again. Mm. And I thought, hang on, that's the image I took, but it's not mine. It's clearly Joe Cornish's image. And then it just lost me for them. But what it got me thinking, and I think I asked you about this briefly last time we met, is that when you're creating these compositions and people then, I don't want to say copy, because I didn't copy you, it was so subconscious. Mm. That image was obviously in my mind from many times I've probably seen it in the past. And it just really struck me that kind of the inspiration that you take from people sometimes comes out in exactly the same way, even though it's completely unintentional.
Yeah, sometimes it's location based, I think, isn't it? And there are certain places, and that maybe that's one of them, where all the elements, it is like a jigsaw puzzle, and everything flows into one particular place where you kind of end up having to put the camera with a particular lens perspective to make it work.
Yeah.
Whereas other places, anything's possible. It's difficult to understand that. It's just a big difference between places.
Yeah. Do you find that happens more with one lens than another? Does a lens choice have any bearing on it?
Not really. No, I think it's just the place and just the elements. I mean, that spot is... it's a view of Rosebery, and it just so happens that this beautiful larch has evolved there over, grown up since probably the end of the 19th century, and occupies that space along with its kind of brethren, and just because of the way that it sits, like a sentinel there, describes a space literally, and then the topping is framed by it, and so there's a very natural way that it evolves. So I was lucky to probably be the first person to realise it was a picture, because I certainly don't have any recollection of certainly seeing photographs or paintings of it from that spot. So but there are other places like that, and certainly places I've been to where I've made photographs inspired by other photographers. But I have to say, I always try to avoid doing the same picture, not because it's it's partly a sort of sense of respect, and also out of sheer bloody mindedness, I want to do my own thing.
Yeah, I'm like that as well.
Yeah.
How do you, if you're visiting a new location, how do you go about your research, or do you look at other images from the area, or you just...
I try not to. I mean, I do think that one of the problems, in a way, that modern photographers have is that they know too much. And therefore, it's very difficult to go to a place innocently and discover it for yourself.
Yeah.
In a way, that's, I try to work locally as much as possible. But I still think there's a lot to be said for the travel experiences that you have. They broaden the mind and they give you that novelty and excitement and that sort of childlike sense of wonder at finding a new place. And I genuinely believe that if you spend too much time looking at Google Maps and existing photographs of those places, how can you have a new experience of it?
It's true. I am guilty of it, though, in the past, where I've had severely limited time in a new location. I'm kind of thinking, it's a new approach I'm trying to take now of not doing this, but... doing that sort of research, not looking at images per se, but some of the reading about the popular locations and stuff, because there is something there. But I think, like you said, you mentioned shooting locally, that's something I'm trying to do more and more, and going out without any sort of preconceived ideas, and just because sometimes when you do that anyway, stuff happens, doesn't it? Like the conditions present themselves in a way that you've never seen before, even though you've been to that landscape 50 times before.
Well, we're lucky in the UK because it literally is never the same day to day, because of the lights always changing and the seasonal change is so spectacular here. If you go to a country where it isn't, you certainly realise how lucky we are, to experience the extraordinary differences. And and of course then, I think there's several arguments for stressing the need or the idea of working locally, and not the least of which is environmental impact and trying to minimise our carbon footprint. But also creatively, it's actually very, very good, because you've already done the obvious photographs locally. Most of us will do probably the first 2, 3, 4 times that we go out there. But by continuing to visit it, you then discover new relationships that you might not otherwise have thought of, and that it forces you to kind of engage your brain creatively.
I was watching another photographer recently who said, talking about you can't control the weather, which is very obvious, but in some respect you can with landscape photography if you shoot locally, can't you? If you think, right, I want the sun, I know the sun moves in that kind of arch as the seasons go by, I want it there, I want it in snow, you can, if you go back enough, you can create that, can't you?
Yeah, the control is the timing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's timing. It's exactly right. You don't, both things are true, though. Therefore, you can't control it, but what you can do is control when you go. And then by positioning and by pre-planning and all of that. But, you know, the funny thing about that is that, I mean, I used to be, I think, a really strong advocate of trying to calculate things and analyze and all of that. And I think that's a really good foundation, craft foundation for the photographer. It's like to develop your technique and your kind of understanding of how light and form, shape, color, texture, line, and so on work together. But then you also want to be able to give it all up and just go out when you fancy it. And I've learned over the years, I think, that that there's a, if you've already imbued those skills and experiences, well, then you can also go out without any preconceptions or without any.
It feels like it's through my sort of, compared to you, limited time doing photography, it's felt like a bit of a cycle from initially just getting into photography because I love the landscape. And then as you start to learn all the technical aspects, you go into that more planned way of doing things. And then now I think I'm coming back out the other side of that now, trying to
It's to true. And I think the harder, in a way, one of the biggest challenges for photographers is you know, as you say, you start with that love of being outdoors and just all the therapeutic benefit it has. And then as you become absorbed by the medium, there is a risk that you can become too absorbed by it and then you lose the magic. And I think the only you know, it probably happened to everybody at least a little bit from time to time, it certainly has to me. All you can do is just keep going. You still enjoy being outdoors, but there will come certainly I think there will come a time again where you find yourself emerging from the kind of the immersion in the process and being yourself again, because it's a state. I think a state of creative evolution, like the stages of life in a way. That with time, as you learn these different processes. There's an old saying, isn't there, that you get it and forget it. So as you get it, we used to be about equipment, but it's, you know, but it's also true of process. So you think of I've got it, and so once you of course it's not that you learn something and never forget it, but as it's immersed in you, you can always draw on an idea or a technique or a thought process which is absorbed and adapt it to new situations that you find yourself in.
So with someone like yourself who's been doing it for a very long time and has obviously success and a very well-established portfolio, I think it's something people often ask me about, is like, what on days when it doesn't go right, have you had many of them? Not necessarily in terms of enjoyment, but photographically.
I genuinely would say that over the last 12 years, I'm thinking now back to the day when I kind of committed to shooting digitally. Probably only the last two have been ones where I feel like the majority of days I go out, I come back with something I'm quite excited about. Nice. Prior to that, 10 years of, I was laboring away with great sincerity and commitment and occasionally producing pictures I like, but a lot of the time I wasn't that happy as a photographer, but I was still happy being in the landscape.
Having experience, it's about redefining what success is, isn't it, I guess?
Well, it is, and after all, you know, that all of this evolution is complicated by the fact that, you know, I started off shooting independently in 1984, and so my career path went a particular way as a working photographer. And then over time it's evolved into something quite different. But saying that, I still do shoot commissions, but an awful lot of the time I'm in education and leading tours and groups and so on, which is a different set of skills. So whereas once my work did have to be, in a way, looking back 5 minutes, quite pre-planned and quite analytical in order to make sure that problem-solving skills were all in place, now I just shoot purely for myself.
That's nice, isn't it? It's a privilege as well, isn't it? To an extent, I have to constantly remind myself of that now.
It's wonderful.
You're not sort of juggling it around family and work commitments. It's really nice.
Yeah.
Check on that. Yeah, that's all right. So, just to take you back to the start a little bit, how did you get into photography? Was it, did it happen naturally, or was it something you had an interest in? How did it begin?
Well, yeah, it began at uni, so I'm quite a late starter.
Right.
Really, I was doing fine art at university and finding that my particular kind of skills and assets from having been a youngster were drawn obsessively ever since I was a nipper.
Right, okay.
Weren't serving me well in that context.
What kind of drawings were they?
Oh, yeah, realistic ones. I used to copy things, you know, just copying madly. And I did some stuff that you could say is quite creative as well, but I was in at the department at Reading. I felt like I was constantly trying to push a boulder up a hill, and that I didn't necessarily get the support that my skills needed.
Yeah.
And the camera was, it became, I got my first camera and found the process of looking through it was a revelation. So that was, yeah, it grabbed me it straight away. And my goodness, you know, looking back at a time when camera technology is nothing like it is now.
No.
But I found that process, and then very quickly shooting black and white film and processing my own, which it was a disaster. And then suddenly I kind of, it all clicked, and that rapidly got me through to my final degree show, which was nearly all black and white photographs, actually.
Okay. In what genre?
Landscape.
Right, okay. So it was landscape from the start.
Yes, yeah. Why? Because I tried other things, and I have tried other things subsequently, but essentially I'm quite a private person, quite shy, and might not seem so now, but no. And so, you know, when you're out in the landscape, you're just dealing with your own thoughts and emotions and responses to the physical experience of being in nature. And that was much more convivial to me than being around people and having to solve the problems of choreographing work with people, which is actually where there's a much more, or at least at the time, it's much more commercial opportunities there than photographing landscape.
Yeah. So when the commercial opportunities came along, did you pursue them, or did they come to you? How did that develop?
It's really hard to say, because my first few years as a photographer was general practice, doing portraits and also machinery.
So you put you did all the groundwork.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
Jobbing photographer.
Yeah, very. Yeah, absolutely. And then I got a kind of break, which was that I was asked to do a book on the founders of the National Trust.
Okay.
It wasn't by the National Trust; it was by an independent writer.
Right.
Curiously, he had a budget of £400 for photography. So he drove me to most of the locations, and the whole thing seems so funny in retrospect, but the beauty of it was that it was an opportunity for me, and my publisher at the time liked what I'd done, so they then launched this set of guides, regional travel guides on Europe, and that's how it all began.
Yeah, that's good.
Well, it was. I mean, it's funny now, because there's no such opportunity for young photographers today. So yeah, I was very lucky.
Yeah,
right place, right time.
So have you always been based in the Northeast then, or is that?
I was in London actually working. I'm from Exeter, so from the other end of the country, and ended up in London, I suppose, because it's the you know, heart of all commerce and creative industries and so on. And anyway, once I'd established a little bit of momentum there, and got together with Jenny, we decided neither of us really wanted to live in the city, so we moved then.
Yeah, okay. That's not dissimilar to my experience, although I was born in the North East and then moved to London, and that's where my photography business began, doing weddings, because I was a police officer before.
Yeah.
So that kind of it gave me, because it was shift work particularly, it gave me the opportunity to kind of work around that and build up a business to the point where it started to become realistic to actually pursue doing it full time. And then obviously riding on the YouTube wave as well helped.
Yeah. yeah, different opportunities.
And then, but when I was down in London, all of my landscape photography was just on trips, because it's much more challenging doing it down there, where obviously I lived in Hertfordshire, so there is opportunities with the right light and the right weather in certain places, a bit of woodland and that kind of thing, but mountainous sort of coastal scenes were quite hard to come by. I know you obviously recently been, and we chatted about it briefly last time that we were together, about the environmental side of things. What's your sort of, because obviously you have done a lot of travelling, haven't you, sir?
Yes, exactly, and it's a big problem in a way, but I mean, just to put it into perspective, I've been interested in ecosystems all my life, adult life anyway. I read a book by James Lovelock called Gaia, A New Theory of Life on Earth, back in late 70s, and that was really fascinating. So it's a scientist writing about the Earth and how things interrelate, and although his theory has been challenged by later generations of scientists, the general principle that nature is a kind of self-regulating mechanism, there's clearly a lot in that, and how interdependent everything is around us. And so I was concerned by his comments at the time that we were changing the Earth's ecosystem by adding carbon to it. So this is early 80s. So yes, I was interested in how we could, you know, what we were, and I could also see just from, you know, being quite young and from being a child and seeing how the world was changing around us, more and more buildings everywhere, more and more roads, and farming techniques have become more and more industrialized. And it was a concern from the word go, and actually it was particularly good for me when I started working for the National Trust at the end of the 1980s, to then see how there were already organisations that were had as part of their primary concern the preservation of nature and of landscape in particular. And that's something that we should all be interested in, and so I was able to start focusing more my own efforts and endeavours into trying to be part of that movement. So that was from a very long time ago.
Yeah.
However, it's also true that at the time I think our degree of self-consciousness was lower, and certainly my own impact in terms of fossil fuels, I was aware that I was using them. I didn't really associate my own driving activities probably with making a major contribution to atmospheric, you know, carbon addition.
But we didn't know, did we? It wasn't not to the extent that we do.
I think we probably thought it was too trivial, or that we didn't need to take personal responsibility. I think we probably felt that it was down to governments and that wise heads in government would make the necessary changes. And as we know, that's not the case.
I think it's still a problem. I find it's still a problem with human nature, though, and particularly the way we manage risk, because the risk is with climate change and the environmental stuff, the risk is still not now, is it? It's like it's some way down the line. So that kind of instinctive reaction to fear that protects us, we don't have it to climate change, because it's difficult to conceptualise in your mind sometimes.
It's too far in the future. At least, especially in the UK and northern countries like Russia, Canada, you probably, what are the risks? The risks are that for them, for countries like Russia and Canada, that their permafrost regions will become more accessible.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's huge risks for countries that are equatorial, or like Australia or parts of the United States, where they're becoming increasingly fire hazard related and so on. So we do have to think ahead, I feel, and also I think it's important for individuals, and especially for people who are lucky enough, as you know we are, to be able to have this encounter with nature on a regular basis. We see changes. They are subtle changes, admittedly, but there are changes going on, you know, year on year, decade on decade, and to at least be part of it's about having a sustainable future for children, our children, grandchildren, and beyond. And that's simply a moral position, ultimately, I think.
Yeah.
I think to carry on business as usual is simply not sustainable.
What things are you interested in terms of how we're going about solving it now? Whether it's scientific or pressure on the government, or is there anything that you'd sort of catch in your eye or you're interested in or a part of?
I think I wish I could say I was part of it. I mean, only in that at home, Jenny and I don't use the central heating any longer. So we just wear lots of clothes in the winter. And we have photovoltaics on the roof, and we also have thermal hot water panels on the roof. But, I mean, we're lucky we could afford to do that. You know, not everyone can do that. We also grow a lot of our own food. So that's very fortunate for us, and I don't see that as virtue signalling. It's just trying to do what you can. Things like recycling should just be a habit for everyone. And consider it, and just thinking more about what you're doing, and you know the stuff that we buy. I do try to offset my carbon footprint, especially with all flights. But I over offset, but you know that I still.
Is that what you're doing to offset? What are you doing to offset?
Trees mainly.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So it's just investing in tree planting, and also there's a couple of other charities that we contribute to. But I mean, I actually think probably that that is more about applying pressure to governments indirectly, because what they can see is that more and more people are concerned about it and actually putting their money where their mouth is, i.e. they're actually saying, yeah, we do care about this, and maybe we're actually going to fly less.
One of the things I never quite understand is, there probably are reasons, but with house building, is why there isn't top-notch insulation and solar panels and things like that built in straight away. And
whether that
needs to be legislated for, I don't know, but it just seems obvious.
It just seems
so obvious, though.
It is obvious.
If a developer wants to develop this plot of land, you've got to spend this little bit more to make it more environmentally
sustainable. Not only that, but if we were to ramp up production by having a legislated for building regulations, then the cost of solar would fall, the cost of triple glazing would fall, the cost of all of these of the latest tech in insulation would fall. And so although it would cost a little bit more with each house, there are developers who are doing it, it has to be said. It's not all bad, but it's at the moment it's voluntary, and it should be obligatory.
It just seems so obvious. Every time I see new bills going up and they don't have any of that, I just don't understand it.
It's baffling, yeah, absolutely.
There's a few sort of scientific developments. Did you see the other day? There was a story, I think it was a university in the UK, so I can't remember where it was exactly. But they've been working on creating hydrogen on site through solar power, I think. And they create their own, they sort their own heating out as well. And they put 20% hydrogen into the gas supply.
Right.
And they were saying that if the whole country could do that, it would reduce the carbon footprint to the equivalent of taking 2.5 million cars off the road. And I thought that kind of research I find fascinating. And it's similar to the house thing with the legislation. It's just these easy wins that we could do. And hydrogen isn't easy, to be fair. To create hydrogen is still not straightforward. But it's just little easy wins I think we need to be picking up at the same time as trying to do the best we can personally.
Well, the fact is that there is a lot of momentum, but there's going to be much more in the immediate years to come. Mm. When you think of the amount of money that's invested in fossil fuel production and research and extraction, and a figure that springs to mind is 1.6 trillion in the last 2 years being devoted to extracting oil and gas from the ground. If you could apply that kind of investment into looking for alternatives, then I think we'd make progress really quickly. And it is a worry that there is inevitably so much invested interest in in keeping things as they are. We all have an interest in it because we all want to drive, but and carry on living the lives that we do. But actually, we do have to learn to change too.
It does go somewhat against human nature, though, doesn't it, to kind of put the brakes on the progress we're making. I don't know if there's ever been a period in history where that's happened necessarily without some kind of catastrophe. But I guess that's what we're going toward, isn't it?
I've described it as a third world war already, and although I think that might sound a bit sort of ridiculous, I think it would help if we did see it that way, because as we've seen with previous world wars, when societies need to adapt to crises, they can adapt very fast. Very fast.
So
it could be done. It's just the will, it's a political will.
Yeah. That's always been, in the past when that's happened, it's always been an immediate threat, though, hasn't it?
This is a very philosophical conversation, but it's true. I mean, human nature is human nature and its economics. Mm. If you can, we're already seeing now the cost of electrical production is reducing massively with solar and wind, both now being their direction of travel is cheaper. In fact, they are cheaper than using gas, for example. And so, inevitably, what that will mean is that gas power. Power stations are going to diminish in number or demand in the UK, but we also have to think about how we can support and help other countries and lead the kind of global movement in the right direction. And that includes not offshoring all our carbon, because at the moment, we're asking, through the economic system, China to make everything for us.
Yeah.
So they're actually having to. To do it for us, and that's
as soon as you ask people to pay a little bit more, they don't want to.
Well, no.
I think last time we spoke as well, I was one of the things I'm concerned about is whether I personally am part of the problem or am I part of the solution by doing landscape photography. But not only that, is then sharing it with everybody on YouTube. And one of the things it was after we'd been together last time, we talked about that for a little while, didn't we? And then I think. I started to do a lot more research. I think I'd started before we spoke last time, but particularly about locations in the UK, which is where I spend the majority of my time. And not necessarily, it's not really to do with climate change, but just about looking after the environment and not spoiling it through litter and too much footfall and that kind of thing. So I spoke to, I think he was an environmental scientist or something. I can't remember exactly what he did, but what he was saying is that what a lot of the time the national parks do is that obviously they try and attract visitors, don't they? It's a big part of what they do.
Yeah.
But what if there is a sensitive environment, what they will often do is build a visitor centre or somewhere to attract people to another area away from that. Mm. So now if I go into those locations, like a well-known hill in the Lake District where everybody, Luffrigg Fell, for example. Mm-hmm. I'm quite happy to say I'm on Luffrigg Fell because people are going there anyway. It's not. Yeah. I'm not really driving any more people to go there. If, however, it's somewhere off the beaten track, I've gone exploring, I'm now not sharing those locations. I did a little bit before, but I'm now not. If two or three people do some research and figure out where I was, I don't think that's the end of the world, but by me making it easy, I'm not going to do that anymore. Some people ask me for the GPS locations and stuff, and I say I'm not giving you that. So because I don't want to be part of the problem. Essentially, I think I said to you last time. I genuinely think that we are partly raising awareness. I think as landscape photographers, particularly, I think the vast majority are people that really care about the landscape anyway.
So yes, exactly. If I look back to, I wrote an article for the National Trust magazine back in the early 1990s, and I said, that what I feel landscape photography, nature photography can do is to provide a translation, a record, and a statement about the beauty that we have that we will also stand to lose if we don't care about it. And I still feel that's an important part of our role. Is to provide a kind of locus around which people can be inspired. And obviously that does attract people to go to those places. And after all, how else do you become connected with nature other than to encounter it? It's just that it doesn't require going to necessarily everybody going to the same place. And, you know, it's just as relevant to find inspiration, say, in maybe by looking through magazines or online or whatever, and then go to your local woods and find inspiration there. You know, if you're lucky enough to live in Cumbria, you know, that's obviously on your back doorstep. Yeah. But, you know, most people don't, because most people, after all, live in the UK, live in the southeast of England, in London. But having said that, one of the things that's amazing about the UK is so much open landscape still, in spite of the density of the population.
Yeah.
And we do have many, you know, many wonders that are very accessible. We have a fantastic range of footpaths, accessible footpaths, far more than most countries, which allows people to go out and enjoy being outside and get some physical exercise, see the sky and just be out and, you know, not have work-related issues on their mind. And just look at the processes that are all around you. You don't have to be standing in front of, I don't know, the Old Man of Store or the Kerrang to be able to experience the beauty of being outside.
Mm, absolutely. So a lot of the locations that are more accessible to people are often busier as well, aren't they? And I went to Durdledore for the first time just before Christmas, because I was down for the Light and Land Christmas day, and I thought, well, I'm gonna go because it's only an hour away from where I am, and I'm not gonna make a journey down all the way down south just for Durdledore. So I'll make the most of it while I'm there. On the morning that we woke up in the hotel, it was absolutely trouncing it down. Like, it was so wet. And everyone was saying to me, are you going to go? Are you going to go? I was like, I'm not sure. And I went in the end, got there, and it was still tipping it down. I thought, I'm just going to go and see what happens. And then the sea was, Sam Gregory had said the sea, there's a good chance of it being really blue. And it was fantastically blue. And then just as I got down onto the beach, the weather cleared. It wasn't sunny, but it had like some really nice detail in the clouds and stuff. And I had the beach all to myself. And then about 10 minutes later, it was full of people. And then everyone, when I showed it on YouTube, everyone was saying, where were all the people? How did you manage that?
Yeah.
And I said, well, just go out in bad weather.
I think there's so much to be said for going out in bad weather, for that very reason, that you do have the place to yourself usually, or more or less. So there's so much of being in nature. It's, of course, it is nice if it's nice weather, but honestly, when you start walking, you can enjoy all weather.
And what I also find is, if you come across somebody going through similar hardship to you, whether it's getting up first thing in the morning, climbing a mountain, or going out in bad weather, if you meet those people, they're always really nice people.
Absolutely.
Because awful people don't climb mountains. you don't meet terrible people at the top of a mountain. They're always really nice. Oh, that's certainly my experience.
Yeah. Well, just generally, I think people are inevitably usually happier when they're outside. Mm. I certainly am.
Yeah, me too. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So the just change the subject entirely. Your gallery. What's the setup you've got there? Tell me a bit about it.
Well, it's all kind of feels a bit like it happened by accident, because I'm not a business person really, and it wasn't particularly my. Well, I say that, but in fact, it's a bit of a dream, I suppose, in one way. But when I started, it was with a couple of friends who are designers, and they saw an opportunity to make cards and sell calendars. That was really the idea. That's how it started. And anyway, long story short, we started selling a few prints in the space that we rented, which we then ended up buying. And then we ended up moving to a bigger building because we felt we wanted to be able to expand. Although, in a way, it was really my friends who drove the process. I wasn't that bothered about the sort of size of it. I just, it would have been nice to have a little space and show a few prints, you know, but it, because it is quite a big building where we are in Northallerton, we've got to find ways of using it. And so actually the nice thing about that is that it's forced me to think more deeply about what can I do to help, and what is the best way to use the opportunities that have arisen. And so the way that we've done that is to make it a community gallery. So although I've got a few prints in there, we've got loads of other photographers with work in there, fantastically talented and amazing artists, many of them, it's just because it's such a big space, we're able to keep it quite changeable. And we have lots of events there as well, in many ways it's not really about the money, because it's very difficult to make a living, frankly, in a gallery, but it is about the photography, the idea of nature and the landscape as a source of inspiration and hope and renewal, and it's that fusion and about the community coming together around those things. And that's what we're trying to do.
Definitely appeals to me. I'd love to have some kind of impact on that, to inspire people locally as well. I think it's quite a special thing.
You're very welcome to come and
I certainly will. You did say it's got great coffee as well last time.
We've got a fantastic cafe. In fact, it's the cafe that's really, really kind of been the best part of it business-wise in the last few years. And it is one of the things that helps any retail space, I believe, because retailers are struggling against the kind of might of Amazon. But if you can create an experience in a gallery, it's a really friendly space. It's not like going into a kind of White Cube London space and being intimidated by everything in there. People love coming in, and you don't obviously have to buy anything, but you know people look around and. Now, with a bit of luck, if people do buy something, it obviously helps us to keep going. That's the bottom line. It is otherwise very difficult, and we do employ quite a few people too. So, it's something I'm proud of. But I'm slightly uncomfortable about the whole thing of there being a place with my name on it.
Are you?
Yeah.
Just because you're humble, or
I probably prefer to fly below the radar. at the same time, it's very difficult, because if I didn't have it, I might feel differently. I might be envious of it. I don't know. It's difficult to say. But for me, doing photography is the enjoyment and the love of being outdoors and sharing that with others. And pursuing my own selfish agenda as an artist, which is making images that get me really excited. And then I suppose there's a feeling you want to share them. So the gallery gives you a space. And I must say, one of the best things about it is it's helped me to become a printer.
Right.
So, you know how to make films, but the other thing, you probably know how to make prints as well. So the printing is my thing, other than... and shooting pictures, and now that I've been printing for really 15 years, I think, and still learning every day, and I love doing it. And
actually, I've got another story for you actually about printing, because when we were together last time, you said something about printing that I really took on board, it has actually changed my printing and my photography probably quite significantly, because one of the things you said was that you approach every single photograph as if it was going to be, I'm probably paraphrasing, as if it was going to be a print. So that's when you're stood in the field, or it's always the final print that's sort of in your mind. And I sort of applied that to my own work. I feel like it's really benefited.
It helps you think about, in quite an analytical way, about what am I doing? What's the purpose of it? Probably it's one of those things that I said then, which was definitely meant sincerely, but reality is that you don't always think every time camera.
Quite.
But it's a helpful...
It's an intent, isn't
concept.
It?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. So after all, you probably... I mean, to some extent, I think all human beings, when making pictures, you know, click the button just because there's something quite satisfying about it. But it's still the actual... ultimately, if you're thinking... I mean, you think of Ansel Adams, for example, who everybody's heard of, I guess, and knows about, and you know, had this concept of pre-visualization, and you know, thinking about the print. So what I've said is nothing new there. I mean, it's just you can then try to imagine the print on the wall and ask yourself, is it good enough for that purpose?
Yeah.
And that's you know, what's the idea? What's the idea of it? Why is the lens in this particular point? What's it revealing by being at that point in space? What would change if I went further back or further forward, up, down, and all those things? And you know, fundamentally, you can be very actually analytical, almost scientific about elements of composition and light, and I think that is helpful. And yet, on the face of it, the point is to touch the heart. So it becomes, it's both a matter of analytical process, but also of, you know, ultimately, human beings, we are driven by ideas and emotions, and that's...
Is the reaction of people something that you're seeking? Is that...
No, because I genuinely, I'm not that clever. All I can think is for myself. I just... maybe that's how it has to be. For me, it's if I respond to something, then I get excited about it. I honestly cannot for a second think, I wonder if somebody else will like that, or, you know, do I even care about that at that moment? In the moment of making the photograph, I can only process it through my own, the filter of my own mind and heart, and that's how it works.
I think that's a healthy approach. It's something I kind of, before I started putting my work out on YouTube, it was something I sort of decided, I'm just going to put everything out, because... almost every single time you'll have some people that hate it, some people that don't mind or are indifferent, and you have some people that love it almost every single time, so it's pointless trying to...
Well, how can you...
You can't please... But you only need to please yourself.
Well, we've got eight billion human beings on planet Earth or something now, isn't it? And every single one of them is unique.
Yeah.
You're bound to get a few people who don't like what you do. And it'd be quite worrying if
sometimes
everybody
they tell you
it.
Quite aggressively, though.
Well, that's your fault for being on YouTube.
Yeah, it is.
That's true.
Yeah.
So, are you the sort of person that has a forward plan? What you got a plan for the next 12 months, the next 5 years? Or?
Well, I have a few. I do have a couple of things I'd like to do. The most, I suppose, the thing I'm most keen to try to do is I've got two or three book projects on the go. One is a collaboration with a good friend, and another is I'd like to do a book of landscape photography, which is fundamentally deals with the experience of being a landscape photographer.
Okay.
So inevitably a little bit autobiographical, but it's trying to think. I want to write it for myself. You know, it brings us straight back to the same issue. I have no idea if anybody's interested in it or not. I actually would like to write a book which tries to distill all of the things that I think, feel, and believe about this process. And along the way, reflect on some of the experiences I've had and some of the pictures I've made and what I've learned from that. But it's only to keep learning, really, to write this book, because I've got no idea whether it'd be a success or not, and at this stage I don't care. I'm only interested in what can I do, and can I make something that I would look at and think, wow, that was good.
Yeah,
that's about it.
That's not dissimilar from something I'm working on as well, actually, but it's kind of it's a photograph book at its heart, but it's not. There are hundreds of them, aren't there? Every landscape photographer is doing it at some point. I wanted to do something a little bit different that kind of makes it unique to me. So what I'm working on is kind of using my experience as a police officer and some of the things I've seen and mixing that in. So some stories from the street, essentially, but mixing it in with the kind of life philosophy that that's helped me develop. At the same time, tying it in with what that now means to me as a landscape photographer, and perhaps how people can apply their own life experience to their photography as well.
Interesting point, because actually the most important thing when you, especially if you're a young person trying to figure out what you want to do with your life, what direction is, I just genuinely think that what you should concentrate on is what you love to do and also what you know. So, you know, you may not, I don't know how much you wanted to be a copper back in the day, but the fact is you've got all of that intense experience, and I'm sure it is an intense experience being a police officer, to draw upon, which other people don't have, who also have your love of photography. So, you know, it's unique to you that is the most compelling for other people to read about.
I genuinely think that.
And actually, it's often these very kind of almost quite trivial anecdotes maybe on your life, but they other people, it will resonate for them in some way. I mean, you think of any experience you have of art yourself, whether it's looking at pictures, reading a poem, reading a book, or watching a dance or whatever, you will find common ground in that work so long as it's done with honesty. I think that's the most important thing. But genuine, really authentic expression is all human beings are interested in, it because we're such curious animals.
Right, I'm getting cold.
Yeah, me too.
Right, I'm cold, so I think we should probably wrap it up. But thank you so much for today.
You're welcome.
It's an absolute honour. It is, honestly, every time we sort of see each other, for me to spend time with you, and I appreciate you coming on very much. I'm sure everybody out there will appreciate some of your insight as well. So,
it's a pleasure. I mean, I just, you know, I think that the only virtue I have is I've got this old, and therefore, you know, having had a lifetime of doing photography, I can remember some of it, and so that's really what it's about. And I just feel I've just been very, very lucky to have spent most of my time, most of my life, not having a proper job, and therefore I've been able to go around and just looking at stuff, and it's really nice to be able to share that, and it's the privilege is actually for me to be able to share that with you. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Joe. Cheers.
Cheers.
Okay, so I hope you enjoyed that. He is just an amazing guy, I think. I was just really impressed with how humble he is as well, how supportive he is to the next generation of photographers as well, like people like myself and quite a few others as well. Just a top guy, amazing photographer, and it was great to spend some time with him. I hope you enjoyed it too. So, like I said, 7-day free trial of the Raw Room. I really think you'll get a lot out of it. It can help you take your landscape photography to the next level. After the 7-day free trial, it's $5.99 a month. Gives you access to the Landscape Photography Masterclass, all the other videos on there, and I'm putting up new stuff as often as I possibly can. The YouTube channel is going to go in a slightly different direction. I want to just make videos that are a bit more about the experience and the adventure. There's going to be less tutorial type stuff on the YouTube channel. I want to sort of expand the filmmaking a bit, bring you information from other photographers like Joe Cornish, and I've got lots of plans to get lots of other people on there as well. So there's going to be less tutorial content, I think, on the YouTube channel. There will be some stuff as we go along, but if you want to learn photography from me, then the Raw Room is probably the place to do it. Anyway, I will speak to you again very, very soon. I'm Adam. This is the Raw Room Podcast. Out.